Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we begin our program today by taking a peek at the small but possibly mighty spider brain with our guest. Rafael Rafa Lucas Rodriguez joins us today. He's a professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and he has some fascinating research going on into the brains of some spiders. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. Do you tell us the spider behavior maybe you've observed? Have you seen an interesting spider in your backyard? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for hosting me.
What led to your passion for insects?
Ever since I was a kid, my dad used to take us to the university had an entomology museum. So I just grew up watching beautiful insect collections. And it now in a professional capacity is just their behavior is so interesting and both so alien and so a reflection of how we come to do our own things that it's just endlessly fascinating to watch and describe and test.
I agree, but why? Somebody might ask, why is it important to study insect behavior?
The usual cop-out is that down the line there's applications that can be of interest. For example, if you study basic reproductive behavior or something that ends up being a pest, then it's good to have already known that by the time the pest problem arrives. But there's a more fundamental answer that is it's a component of understanding our own environment. And it's just an enrichment of our own culture and our own broad wealth in the sense of ability to understand and control, regulate our environment.
Yeah, so it can tell us something about our environment.
And something about it. They're a big chunk of our environment. Some insect species are the dominant predator of the places where they occur. For example, in tropical forests, you get large herbivores like tapirs and that kind of thing. But the number one herbivore are leafcutter ants. And they're tiny, but there's just tons of them. Their nests are huge. They have huge impacts on the soil structure and the plant structure of their forests.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was going to say that they're also the questions we learn, the answers we learn from them about how their brains evolve and how their behavior evolves are applicable. You know, they should have enough generality to apply to ourselves as well.
Let's first talk about your research about spiders. How did the brains of these arthropods catch your attention?
That's the thing. Like we have this notion that we know we are smart because we think highly of ourselves and we have relatively huge brains. So animals with small brains, like insects, they have tiny, tiny fractions of what we have. How are they? Initially, we were just thinking, well, they're just little robots. They have fixed programs. That's what they execute. No, they have very flexible behavior. They can do all sorts of problem solving. So then how is that regulated by their small brains? And it turns out that some of the observations are that our brains are like inelegantly structured. There's just much more efficiency and precision in their, I mean, even like some of their brains can be, a honeybee can have up to 1 million neurons in its brain, which is much less than our, so many billion neurons. But 1 million, that's a huge amount of neurons even. And the way they're structured is in many ways similar to how our brain has the different parts of our brains are structured.
I'm trying to envision what the size of a spider brain, say a black widow, how is that like the size of a pencil dot or, you know, how, what?
The little bigger around that, and it varies with the size of the insect. So like across all animals, and that includes insects, relatively larger species and larger individuals have absolutely larger brains. But when the smaller the individual, the larger the proportion of the whole body that the brain occupies. So sometimes you get like minuscule spiders, minuscule insects. Their brains come out of their head and protrude into the thorax and into even their legs. It seems that there's some kind of selection for retaining relatively large brain proportions. And that's all. That's the good that brains do to animals.
That is very, very cool. I did not know that. I bet quite a few people listening didn't know it either. If you could put make our brains the size in proportion to the spider brain, we'd have a pretty big brain.
We would have brain mass in our shoulders. And seeping into our biceps.
Rafa Rodriguez, our guest today, professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and he studies spiders and spider brains and their memory capabilities. And if you want to join in, you can reach us 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. What do we know about a black widow spider's ability to memorize?
So we know that, and this is true for black widow spiders and for many different kinds of web-making spider, they form memories of the content of their web. So, for example, there's a classic experiment that you can do, which is give them something, then take it away. And the result is always that they search for it. So, for example, if they've captured prey and then you experimentally remove the prey, ideally with the least disturbance possible to the spider, then they start searching for it in a way that is completely different from how they normally would zoom in on a prey that just landed on the web. That is very targeted, very direct, very brief. When they're searching for something they lost, they go on for minutes and minutes and minutes. Record we've seen is up to 45 minutes. And at some point, you're like, dude, it's gone. Like, what are you? But they keep on going for that. Right. So that points to they have formed the memory. And the trigger for the searching behavior is the absence of that thing, not the presence of that thing. Then we've done experiments where we give them more valued prey, less valued prey. They search longer for more valued prey. Not with black widows, but with a golden orb-web spider, did an experiment giving them different numbers of prey, and they searched longer for higher counts. So it's in for an animal like that, we don't say they're counting like we do 1, 2, 3, 4, but we say they have a sense of numerosity and a sense of the approximate count level in the end. So that's they're forming memories of the content of their webs. They're using it to regulate their efforts to reacquire if they lose it or if it gets misplaced. They also, with the black widows, my recent PhD student, Clint Sergi, found that they memorize trajectories that they have walked across. They're looking for prey, they're moving across the web. They keep a record, like kind of like a dead reckoning record of trajectories and directions. So then if you scare them and they need to go back to the retreat, they can take shortcuts. So they don't need to retrace the whole thing. They kind of, in a sense, they kind of know where they are. And just like we would do, like we've been shopping all day and then, it's late. I need to get back home. You can take a shortcut back home. So they have that kind of capability.
So how far are they from being conscious beings?
There is an argument that there's many different people will define consciousness differently. There is, like high level thinking. Why do I think about thinking? That's some people would limit it to that level. The most basic sense of consciousness is sentience, right? Having a private, inner, subjective perspective. The philosopher's term of art is there is something it is like to be that creature. In that sense, there's a strong argument for insects and spiders, possibly most vertebrates, many kinds of mollusks to be conscious, in the sense that their brains form a model of their environment and a kind of a virtual reality simulation, kind of like what our brains do, right? A model of the environment and the animal in it. And how they navigate the world is by paying attention to that model. So that's the structure of insect and spider brains suggests that and how it matches our structure suggests they're at least doing that very often, very many species. There's a base level sentience that is out there. That's controversial, but the case is been getting stronger.
Ken in Holcomb emailed us. He has a large yellow and black garden spider with a big web in his grapevines. And he says it seems to spend all of its time at the center of the web. And Ken wonders how they know if their web needed repair. Do they go move around and check it out every day, or can they feel the tensions that some part needs fixing?
They do have the way they sense the world is very alien to us because it's based entirely on the vibrations that come from the silk in the web. So they have eyes, but they're not really image forming eyes. So it's like they navigate by vibrational sonar from like a prey lands on the web, sends vibrations along the silk, the spider perceives them. And that's how they orientate themselves and navigate. So they're very sensitive to vibrations and they're very sensitive to the tensions that the different components of the web have. And that they can detect there's a hole appears, they can fix it. That kind of spider though, spiders like that, they will build a new web every day. So there's not a lot of opportunity for the web to get badly damaged. Other spiders, like black widow spiders, build one web and then they stay with it and they add little bits throughout time. So those can incur a lot more damage, and then that calls for more localized fixing. And they're, you know, even if they're often moving along the web, and there's like fix a little bit here, fix a little bit there. So yeah, they're super sensitive to tensions and vibrations in the web.
So that that black and yellow spider, garden spider, that web is being built new every day.
Yeah, they will eat it. It comes out of glands they have in the tip of their abdomen, to use a polite term, and they're called spinnerets, and it's pure protein. So when they take it down, they eat it, and they regain the protein that they've expended. Then they secrete one the next night.
Oh, Dot in Manitowoc, let's go to you. Hi, Dot. Thanks for calling.
Do all spiders spin a web? And also, can you tell from a web what type of spider it is?
Yes and yes. Not all spiders will build a web for prey capture. There's many that have become, they walk around and hunt for prey, like jumping spiders or wool spiders. But they all have the ability at least to secrete silk. And at the very least, the web they make is, this is a little bit of an adult theme. Is that okay for the show? When males are getting ready to go search for prey, their mating system is very different from ours. First, they have to secrete, they build a web, and they secrete the sperm onto that web. And it's a little tiny triangular sperm capture web. Then they load, they have modified intermittent organs that are modified legs in the front of the thorax. They load the sperm onto those. Then they go looking for females. So even if in a spider that's entirely ambulatory, that walks around hunting for prey, they will at least build that web in a point in their life. And females at least will build egg sacs for their, and a web for the egg sac. So they all can build webs, although not all of them use webs for prey capture. What was the other question?
Can you tell a spider by the web that it weaves?
Yeah, so there is the webs can be distinctive, very, for at least for family level. So normally you have like ordered family, genus, species. They can be distinctive at the genus or the family level, and the movements in which that they use to build webs have been used as characters for classifying species, as taxonomic characters. So they're not necessarily completely diagnostic, but they're very useful.
Very useful. Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, a professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee, our guest today as we talk with him about his research on spiders, their ability, their capability of memory. And boy, it's fun talking with him. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa, our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee. He studies spiders and spider brains. This is some fascinating research in my mind. Questions for him? Join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Michael in Kakana will give you a chance. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. We often see spider webs. You live in kind of a rural area in northeast Wisconsin, and they appear in the morning. You don't see them at night. In the morning, and they're about the size of a small dinner plate, and some of them are like horizontal between a couple of plants that are maybe 3 or 4 feet tall, and we often see them on the ground and the lawn. And they're always full of moisture, and we're trying to figure out what kind of spider that might be, because they're very distinctive. They're very pretty.
Are they? They have an horizontal position, but are they orb web? Are they circular, or are they more like a sheet?
They're mostly circular.
That's very likely a spider called Leucauge. The genus name is Leucauge. It's in the family. I'm just blanking out on the family. Not. Give me the genus is Leucauge, and if you look in the center where the hub is, you can find them. They're gorgeous, green, silver colored. Those are very beautiful. Why am I not remembering the family? Give me a second. I know I'm not remembering, because there's one I like that it used to be in that family, and now it's in a different family. And that's confusing. Give me just one sec. The Trachnathidae is a family.
Trachnathidae, is it?
The Trachnathidae is the family. The genus is Leucage, Leucauge. Those are beautiful. The webs are beautiful. The spider's beautiful. And that's one where you can do the experiment of giving them prey, removing it very easily, because what they do is they attach each prey they catch. They will bring, well, if you catch the first one, they'll start eating it right away. But they'll bring it to the hub, attach it with a line of silk to the hub, like, you know, but just a precaution to not lose it. Then they start feeding. So you can give them another one, and they'll attach each one by a single thread to the hub. So the experiment of removing prey is just cutting that thread. There is no disturbance to the spider. Well, you need to like drive it away to do that. We do that without it sensing you doing it, but there's no hole left in the web. There is no evidence left that there used to be prey outside of the memory of the spider. So that's a really cool family to work with.
So is that kind of how you did your research? I mean, maybe tell us a little more about how you if you got them in a box or something, and what do you do?
Yeah, like if the best, ideally, I could get them to build webs in the lab. And some of these have strong views on where they want to build a web and how. So we don't always succeed. The black widows were super convenient, because you put them in a box, they'll build a web. They're happy to be in your garage or whatever, out on the sidewalk. And then once you have that, then it's like they have their own self-contained universes, right? You have from its point of view, it's on a web. It's got all its senses like it normally has it. And then you can have it in the lab, and it thinks it's in perfectly natural conditions. Sometimes for species that won't, we do that in the field. So I worked with golden orb web spiders. That was, somebody was confusing me because that used to be Tetragnathia, and now it's Nephilidae. And then you can do the same thing. They will attach single prey to each prey by a signal line to the hub, and then do the experiment. And those we do out in the field.
Oh, man. Suzanne in Woodruff, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thank you. Hope I phrased this correctly. A spider that can create its own home, find its space, find its food, doesn't need any assistance from anyone else, eats its garbage, apparently, by eating its web, seems so intelligent to me and so in its amazing simplicity. And it seems to me that that could be the measurement for intelligence if we weren't taking humans into account. Because we humans, you know, we use so much and waste so much, and it's madness to me. And I'm wondering if you have a reflection on that. Thank you.
No, that you're absolutely right. That is, it's highly super efficient. The concept that there's a broad concept here that, you know, animals that make modifications of their own environment. So like the for example, a spider web, it's kind of, it belongs to, it's a trait that belongs to them, but it's not like in of their body, but they built it. Richard Dawkins calls that extended phenotypes. And then you can study them like you study any trait of any animal. Right, they can be, it can vary across according to genetic components, it can vary across according to, they absolutely varies according to environmental components. So it can evolve and be shaped, evolve and be shaped by selection like any trait. So what you refer to about that being smart and efficient, that's not necessarily they reason that from first principles, but over time, selection shaped those adaptations to be a smart way to go about making a living in the world. So I really like that point.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for calling. Fran in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Fran. Have we got Fran there? Fran, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, hi. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm an old person, and I sit underneath my white cedar tree, and I feel like spiders come to me. That is, I wonder what if they're aware of me, because it seems like they are. And people who are old sometimes get very slow and really, really drink in what's going on outside. Like I'm sitting there and the branch is right by my head. And down on a little on that little silken thread comes a spider, and will come right near my eye, and I'm just wondering what their awareness is of me.
I don't think they're necessarily trying to get to you there. I think that's a place where they're on that tree and. Moving around the world, that's how they do. They are another thing I didn't say about silk is, at the very least, every spider is always secreting its own safety line, so it can, so that if you scare one of those spiders that's coming back, it'll just draw itself back up on its silk line. I don't think they're necessarily trying to make friends, but they haven't sensed you yet because they probably don't see you very well. They're sensing the silk, the wind. They sense a electromagnetic field. One thing that young spiders do to disperse is they secrete a line of silk into the air and keep on secreting. You know, the air picks it up. We used to think that the air picked it up, and they keep on making it longer and longer and longer until the drag lifts them off the ground, and then that's how they disperse. And at some point, they come down. Now it turns out that they're using electromagnetic fields to lift the line. It's not the air, not the drag of the air. That's a long way of not answering your question, I suppose.
They use electromagnetic fields.
In particular. Sorry? Yeah. There are many insects that are sensitive to that. Honeybees are, that's the approach. They, part of how they navigate the world is sensing those fields as they approach the plant tissue from the air. Oh. It's like you have to be super close to the substrate. They have to be super close to the substrate to sense it.
Fran, thank you for calling. Jay in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Good morning. I have two questions. One, is it just a natural cycle that there are less mosquitoes, black flies, ladybugs, and also spiders this summer along the normally cooler lake shore of Lake Michigan? Or has that got something to do with climate change? And my second question is, my squeamish daughter just moved into a new place, and her lower level has an old carpet on a concrete floor, and she's got a terrible millipede infestation. Mm. Landlord put down some powder, which is killing them, but I think the carpet should probably be removed, and I'm wondering why they're attracted to coming indoors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's the particularly long-legged centipede. I think it's centipede. I do not like them in the house. It's like I'm supposed to like all arachnids, but I have my limits. Yeah, that carpet sounds like it needs changing. That species is associated with human habitation. There's many species that have become specialized to coexist with us. They use our homes like a resource in a sense. For example, cellar spiders, you know, sometimes they're called daddy long legs. They have flat, kind of flat sheet webs and they're very long legs, very, very elegant bodies. Those we'll find in your basement. That's what they call cellar spiders. I have a student that's working on them and her collecting sites is my basement and her basement. Those will prey on those centipedes. Those catch them and eat them. So one thing you could do is encourage, bring some cellar spiders to that room. Probably your daughter might not appreciate that, but but those are they mind their own business. They don't come near you or anything, and they'll catch prey that might bother you.
And they kind of like moist conditions too, don't they? So that may be why that rug's mm-hmm. damp.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
The other question of, you know, insects and climate change, the state of the art there is, unfortunately, look, it's complicated. There was a recent study by a colleague of mine here at UWM, Peter Dunn, and they had, you know, sampling insects across all of North America. And what they find is that whether the insects are increasing or decreasing varies with the group of the insect and the site. So it's not a simple decline or increase story. It's specific about the ecology of the site and the ecology of the species of insect.
Jay, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to black widows for just a minute. I've heard some male black widows actually want to be eaten by their female counterparts. You think there's any truth to that?
That's true of one species. So a lot of the time, courtship in spiders is delicate because on average, females, you know, for most species, the females are bigger than the males and they're all predators. So a male approaching a female is, you know, wanting romance, but he might get preyed upon instead. That's always a delicate beginning of the interaction. But most of the males are trying to get away with it, you know, to mate and then live to fight another day. There's one species that's called redback spiders. They're an Australian species of black widow spider, where the explanation is that the likelihood of finding another female is so low that there's no point in trying to escape. So then when they mate, actually they start mating, and then they flip their abdomen over and offer it to the female right away. So they're now, so they become a nuptial, you know, like a nutritious gift for the females. And then they start getting eaten while they're still mating. So that's true of that one species. And that's the technical term across animals is called nuptial gifts. There's many, many different species that will capture prey and then offer that prey to the female. In this case, it's the male itself offers himself as the nuptial gift. But that's just the one species. Most of the time, like also you hear this with mantids, most of the males are trying to escape and sometimes fail.
Sometimes they get away, but not always.
Sometimes it doesn't work. But then if they don't risk it, there's no mating. There's no reproduction.
Yeah. Well, one spider you studied was the golden orb web spider. That's a beautiful spider.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. I would say that with most spiders, but these are particularly gorgeous.
Yeah, what are they? Maybe you could, can you describe them for us? They are pretty. I've seen them, but I know you could do a better job describing them.
They have just beautiful, bejeweled silver and green abdomens, and their legs are banded black and yellow. They're about, 3-4 inches from across the legs. And they build gold. The silk is actually golden. That's why they call the golden orb web spider. And their webs are maybe 3-4 feet across. And they're always like in trails along, trails along forest or outside. So it's very easy if you're walking and you're not minding your business, you'll run smack into one of their webs. And the silk is very strong, so it's difficult to extricate yourself from it. I'm from Costa Rica initially, and I took a spider course in Costa Rica. The professor there had made silk. He collected, from several webs, made a silk string. It was like 3/8 of an inch, something very, very thin. And he attached it to, he had an old Isuzu Trooper. And then we pulled his car with that very thin silk thread. And it didn't break. It was like, it's the strength of spider silk, relatively speaking, is stronger than steel. So a lot of biomaterials research is what can we learn from spider silk to make very resistant, very light materials.
Light and strong. Yeah.
That's what one of the things that from your initial question, what good comes out of it is down the line, we learn things that then we can be applied. But if we weren't doing the curiosity-based research first, we would never even think of that possibility.
Yeah. And your research on that seems to show that they have the ability to count.
In a very basic sense, yes. Not they're not taught arithmetic at school, but they have a sense for how many they've encountered, which makes for navigating the world makes a lot of sense for animals to have that capability.
And so, how did you do that? How did you do that research?
That was that experiment that was with the golden orb spider is how I was saying because they attach each prey by a single thread. If you give them, you give them one, let it bring them, they'll start to feed on it. Then another one, then another one, then another one. In the span of a few minutes, you can get them to create larders. They're literally hanging the little ham, not hams, but crickets from their hub. And then what you do is you steal the whole larder. So you can experimentally give them, have a larder of one prey or two or four. That's what we did. Mm-hmm. Then steal those. And they search longer for four than for two than for one. At that point it's vulnerable to a naysayer saying, well, they were just keeping track of the overall amount, not the counts. So what we did was have equivalent mass numbers. So one large prey, that was the mass of four small ones, or one medium one, that's what the mass of two small ones, or just a one, right? So we could see how they tracked overall mass, and we could see how they tracked counts for small prey. And they counted, they tracked both, so they're also keeping track of overall amount, which also makes sense. But it was steeper and cleaner with counts than with mass. So that kind of cinched it for the numerosity ability.
Oh, man. So your research on this is... Oh, by the way, I wanted to mention that UW-Milwaukee did a really nice little video on your research. I loved it. And I'm pretty sure that Trina LaSousa has already posted it up on my page today. It's a very cool little piece on your research and kind of what we've been talking about today. So if you want to see that, go to ideas at WPR.org/Larry and today's date. And right in the comments section, you'll find a link to that note. And Clara, I said Trina, I think I meant Clara Neipert, our producer, put that in there. So do you teach as well in this, by the way, Rafa?
Yeah, I teach. So I teach a general ecology course. That's a third year level, and then a behavioral ecology course. And that's where I use a lot of these examples. That's a higher level undergrad, graduate level, and a graduate seminar as well.
And communicating, we didn't even get to that, but communicate, insects have all different kind of ways to communicate, don't they?
Yeah, tons of them. A lot of them are doing chemical communication. I work with sound, with acoustic communication. And most of the time we think of crickets and that kind of thing, you know, like it can be pretty, it can be more broadband, but it can be very repetitive. The insects I work with communicate sending substrates along the tissues of their hostland. So it's sound in the absolute definition of a mechanical disturbance of a medium. But you could pick it up if you bit the stem on which an insect is doing that. Your jaw bones would bring it to your ear bones, because our ear bones are modified jaw bones. Mm-hmm. So then you could literally hear what they're doing, but you have to tap into that substrate in some way. And those are completely different signals. They sound like birds. They sound like whales. They're much less repetitive, much more varied, much more. That like reveals their brains are capable of a lot more complexity than we had initially anticipated from the simpler sounds that insects make when they radiate into the air.
Rafa, this has been really eye-opening and interesting and a whole lot of fun for me and everybody listening, I'm pretty sure. I hope you can come back sometime and be with us again. I'd love to have you back.
I'd be happy to. This was a lot of fun for me, too.
Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And again, if you want to see that video, Clara posted a link on our page. So ideas at WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date, and in the comments section, there will be that information. Coming up, there's some cool things going at the Milwaukee Harbor District, and we're going to talk about some breakwaters and some new research on that. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.